I wouldn't have been able to lose it in the first place, she thought in frustration. Most people didn't carry external PMs anymore. It was just one more reminder that she was a freak. Then she heard a faint rustling. It was low enough that she hadn't paid any attention to it before, but now that she was paying attention, she could tell it was being caused by the movement of something. She turned her back on the wounded stranger and scanned the rocks and brush around them. Matthew must have great hearing, she thought. And then she saw it. A surge of adrenaline shot through her as the dark head appeared some 30 feet away. She had been careless. Where was her bag? She had a can of bear spray inside it. Turning, she looked back at the litter, only to find the stranger standing. "What are you doing?" she asked in surprise. Matthew pointed. "Bear." Another word they had in common. She nodded. "Yes, a bear. How are you standing?" She ignored the mystery of the stranger being on his feet, while her eyes searched for her bag. There it was, lying on the ground on the other side of the litter. She heard the bear again, louder now. It was close, and no longer making any attempt to disguise its approach. Karen started to step around the stranger, but he put a hand on her shoulder, forcing her to stop. Drawing his sword, he handed it to her carefully. He said something as her hand reflectively closed over the hilt, but again she couldn't understand, and then he stepped around her, heading in the direction of their assigned visitor.
"What are you doing?"
Karen hissed, her eyes wide. Matthew walked directly toward the bear. His stride was relaxed, almost casual, even though the beast was now less than 10 feet away. There was nothing but open space between them now. Raising his arms and holding them wide, he barked a command at the massive creature. Karen knew confidence and a bold posture could sometimes force a bear to move away, but this one appeared to be having none of it. It charged forward, but her strange companion never flinched as the grizzly rushed toward him.
"He's fucking crazy," she muttered,
preparing to scramble for her bag. The bear growled, bearing fangs that looked big enough to be daggers as it swiped at the young man with one paw. Matthew batted the paw away, as though he was brushing off an attack from a small child. Then he flicked his hand toward the bear. Karen felt or saw something. A flash of light or heat washed over her, followed by a wave of vertigo. Whatever it was seemed to strike the bear, and she saw its head jerk from some sort of impact. It reared up on its legs, enraged, but then Matthew said something, and it fell backward, losing its balance. Again she felt something, though her eyes seemed to argue with her other perceptions. Matthew yelled at the bear again, waving his arms menacingly as it hastily got back on its feet. The grizzly turned and retreated rapidly without stopping to look back. Matthew watched it go, making sure it had truly left, before he turned around and walked back to Karen. She was holding the bear spray now, and she stared at him with her mouth agape.
"What the hell were you thinking? That thing might have killed you. It should have killed you."
He still couldn't understand her words, but he caught the gist, she was sure, because he responded by shrugging his shoulders apologetically. Karen found the gesture irritating.
"Why did you give me this?"
she demanded, holding the sword up.
"Nobody uses a sword to fight bears, and if you thought they could, you should have kept it."
The young man tilted his head slightly, obviously trying to puzzle out what she was saying. But eventually he replied,
"Sword. You. Safe."
3 words she could understand in one sentence, not that she agreed with any of them, of course.
"No,"
she declared, before pointing to his forehead.
"Stupid."
He stared back at her with a smug, almost indifferent expression, which only made her madder. The idiot had nearly gotten himself killed, and he obviously thought he had saved her. Karen glanced down at the bear spray in her hand and suppressed the urge to pull the pin and spray him with it. She pushed that aside as another thought occurred to her.
"What's with your leg, anyway?"
When Matthew's expression grew more puzzled, she pointed at it.
"Your leg. This. Your leg. How are you walking?"
His face lit up with comprehension. After a long pause, he pointed at himself.
"Wizard."
Karen let the air out of her chest in a long sigh before pointing at him.
"Nut job,"
she corrected acerbically. The young man paused and then nodded.
"Yes, wizard. nut job.
He seemed to think they were communicating. She couldn't help but smile at that.
At least we agree on something. Come on, nut job. We aren't going to get out of this wilderness if we just stand around all day.
Chapter 5 Matthew watched as Karen packed the strange cylinder she was holding back into her bag. When she pointed at the litter and said something to him, he was pretty certain she was asking if he needed to be carried on it again. He shook his head.
No, thank you.
She shrugged and pointed downhill as she said something else. The words all sounded familiar. Once in a while, one would jump out at him, but he knew they were far from properly understanding one another. He swept his arm outward and gave a slight bow.
Lead the way.
He followed her as she picked her way down the steep mountainside. They weren't on a trail of any sort, so the going was rough, and within minutes his leg began to throb and ache. That was just the worst of it, though. Pains in his back, neck, and elsewhere all competed for his attention. Karen looked at him with concern as his mild limp became a pronounced hobbling gait. She said something, but the only word he understood was crutch.
Good idea, he told her.
They were near the bottom now, and the trees were thicker around them. Limping into a stand of small saplings, he selected one that was small enough and fairly straight. Karen pointed at his sword.
No need, he told her,
putting his hand on the tree he had chosen. Concentrating, he sent his Aethar out to follow the length of the tree. It took considerably more effort than he expected. He was beginning to worry, for he seemed to be getting weaker, as though his power wasn't properly replenishing itself. Once his Aethar encompassed the length that he wanted, he clenched his will, cutting the tree neatly off near the ground and at a point higher up. The smaller branches that were attached to that portion also fell away, leaving him with an ideal walking staff nearly 6 feet in length. Karen's eyes widened slightly as he pulled it away with little apparent effort. She looked puzzled, but she didn't say anything. They continued onward, and when they reached the bottom, where a small but gentle valley lay, Matthew wondered how far it would be before they reached her home. Looking upward, he studied the mountain they had descended. To his eyes, it looked much like the others that surrounded them on either side. If they travelled too far, he might have difficulty finding it again.
And Desiccus won't wake up until I can get close enough to give him a command. He needed to mark the location. In fact, he wished he had done that before leaving the cave, but it was too late for that.
Holding up a hand, he motioned to Karen.
Wait a few minutes.
She nodded and pointed at her lower abdomen while saying something and then pointing to a stand of tall, white-barked trees. Matthew got the general idea. She needed a moment of privacy for certain urgent purposes.
Go ahead, he told her.
Then he cast about, looking for what he needed. In the mountains, it didn't take him long to find what he sought, a large boulder with a relatively smooth top. The one he found was a little bigger than he'd have liked, with sides that were almost 10 feet in height. But with the judicious application of a bit of Aethar, he managed to scale it. Once atop the massive stone, he used his finger to channel a small line of power and began carving a circle into it. Teleportation circles were fairly complicated, but the beauty of them was that they labelled a particular piece of space. The fact that he was a stranger to this world, to this dimension, was no problem at all. Once the circle was finished, this spot would have the name or key that he had designated for it. So long as he remembered that key, he could make another circle anywhere that would bring him back to it. Etching the circle and symbols into the stone was hard work. His strength was definitely diminished and growing weaker.
How long will I have to rest to recover? He wondered.
Back home, a few hours were usually all he needed, but apparently in a world without Aethar, it took much longer.
What if I can't recover here?
He wasn't entirely sure if he was still generating his own Aethar at all, and if he wasn't, then he would die when it was exhausted. Aethar was equivalent to life, and it still confused him that the living things in this world seemed to do perfectly well without it. The bear had seemed healthy, and Karen could certainly walk and talk without any discernible Aethar. That wasn't entirely true. Karen hadn't had any Aethar when he had first seen her, but since he had awoken that morning, he had noticed that she had begun to develop a faint trace of it.
Possibly it was from being in such close proximity to him, but he wondered if it was temporary, or whether she might begin to produce Aethar on her own. Only time would tell. He finished the circle. It wasn't his best work. Without having a stylus, the lines were thicker and cruder than they needed to be, and his weakness made them rougher than they might otherwise have been. But it would serve. Karen stood below, looking up at him curiously. No doubt she was wondering how he had gotten up there, since there were few handholds for easy climbing. Matthew grinned at her and jumped down, using a small amount of aether to cushion the shock as he landed. They continued their trek, following the stream that ran through the small valley and heading roughly east. As the day wore on, Matthew wondered how much farther they had to go before reaching Karen's home. She couldn't have travelled very far, since she had almost nothing in the way of supplies or camping gear. When the sun stood highest in the sky, they stopped in a grassy clearing and took a short break. Matthew was starving, and he knew Karen had to be just as hungry. Neither of them had eaten since the previous day. Karen pulled a small, strange package from her bag. He had noticed it earlier while examining her with his mage sight, and he knew it contained some sort of dried food, but the container itself was made of a material foreign to him. In some ways it resembled glass, transparent and shimmery, but it differed in that it was flexible, like leather. She poured a small handful into her palm and handed him the remainder still in the small pouch. Matthew dipped his head. "Thank you." She answered with a short phrase that he felt sure meant something along the lines of, "You're welcome." He filed the phrase away in his memory. Having the gift of the Loshti was handy, since it meant he never forgot anything. Slowly but surely, he was building up a store of phrases as he figured out the meaning behind some of the things she said. The food was bizarre, like everything else she showed him. Some of it was obviously dried grains, and he could identify some pieces as being preserved fruit. The really weird part was the brightly coloured oval bit. He bit one cautiously, and was shocked to find it contained something very sweet. He picked one out and held it out to her, questioning, "What is this?" She understood the question easily enough. "Chocolate." Matthew decided he liked chocolate, though it seemed a strange food to pack for a journey into the wilderness. He ate the rest of what she had given him in two quick bites. It wouldn't be enough to sustain them for long. Of even more concern was the fact that her water bottle was empty. He moved closer to her and tapped it before pointing toward the river. "We should refill your bottle." Karen shook her head negatively and said something. Most of it sounded like gibberish, except for the word bad. "So, the river isn't safe to drink. Hopefully, we aren't far from her home." Karen marched along steadily, trying to ignore the empty knot that her stomach had become. She knew she was in no danger of starving to death, yet. It had only been a day since her last good meal, and they had been able to snack on the last of her trail mix a few hours ago, but her belly seemed convinced that she was in mortal danger. Hunger, true hunger, was not something most people experienced anymore, at least not in the modern world. "Stop complaining," she told herself. "You can last for several days without food." "But will I be able to keep walking all that time?" she wondered aloud. Of even more concern was their lack of water, and she thought longingly of all the water she had left in her pert. If only she had some way to summon it. If only I weren't a freak. Eventually they would become too desperate to ignore the river, and the risk of giardia or some other waterborne illness would be the lesser of two evils. The mountain stream was relatively clear, and it certainly looked inviting. She would have had little concern in using the water if she had some way to boil it first. But she hadn't carried her lighter with her, deeming it needless weight when she had thought she'd be able to summon the pert every evening. "An extra ounce or two doesn't seem like such a waste now, does it?" she chided herself. "Not when you'll be thirsty and freezing your ass off tonight." She glanced to look back at the young man following her. His limp was less pronounced now, partly because of the staff, but likely also because the long exercise had loosened up his bruised muscles. She still didn't understand how he was walking. She had been certain the leg was broken. She had begun collecting a whole host of unanswered questions regarding him. He seemed good-natured, but his apparent lack of caution, particularly regarding bears, was worrisome. She wondered if he had a death wish, or whether he was just naturally foolish. The way he kept referring to himself as a wizard might have been funny if they weren't deep in the mountains with no easy access to food, water, or shelter. The backcountry was no place for fools. "Not that I'm any better," she thought. "I hiked out here with only my PM, and never once considered what might happen if it was damaged or lost." She couldn't deny that weird things kept happening around him, though. Being thrown together during the rock slide was an amazing coincidence, and surviving it was almost a miracle. Matthew's odd bravado when he had scared away the bear was also nearly unbelievable. But she knew that quite often the real world was stranger than fiction. The young man had been incredibly lucky. Of all those things, what bothered her most was the memory of him reaching into the small stand of saplings and pulling one away as though it had been made to serve as a staff. It hadn't looked dead, but that was the only explanation she could come up with. He had gripped it firmly, and it had just snapped off in his hand. All the smaller limbs and the top had fallen away as well. There had been something very unnatural about it, but she couldn't bring herself to believe it had been anything other than sheer luck. And then there was his climbing skill. If he weren't dressed in those odd clothes, she might have thought he was a rock climber. The boulder he had scaled while she was relieving herself earlier was not something just anyone would be able to manage. "Too many questions," she muttered. The sun was getting low in the sky, and she felt torn. They needed to cover a lot more ground if they were to get back to civilization before they starved or died of thirst. But she could also tell that the long hike had taken a serious toll on her companion. Whatever the truth of his injuries was, he had taken a battering the day before. He needed rest. She made up her mind, and when the next clearing presented itself, she held up her hand. "We should camp here." Matthew nodded tiredly, and she wondered how much he had really understood. "Rest," she told him. "Let me have the sword, and I'll try to make a pallet for us to sleep on." Starting early would give her time to gather green grass and possibly make something less uncomfortable to sleep on than the cold ground. He gave her a confused look, and she repeated the key word while pointing at his waist. "Sword." "Ah," he answered, and then unbuckled his belt and handed her the scabbarded weapon. She motioned toward a dead log. "Sit down. Rest. I'll be back soon." After that, she headed back in the direction they had come. They had passed a willow tree not long ago. The long draping limbs and soft leaves would probably make good bedding, and covered with some of the river grass, it might make for a better night's sleep. "Unless I'm allergic to the grass," she muttered. The sword sliced easily through the thin branches, and she marveled again at its sharpness. In a short span of minutes, she gathered as much as she could carry and then began making her way back to their new campsite. The return was a 10-minute walk, and Matthew was missing when she returned. She had been gone less than a half an hour, and she wondered whether she should stop and search for her companion. In the end, she decided against it. If he was stupid enough to leave without her, he wouldn't last long. He had probably just gone off to relieve himself. She piled the willow branches up and went back for a second load. As she walked, she absently noted an abundance of dead wood along the way. A fire would have been nice, but she had absolutely no idea how to start one without a lighter. Even if she had had something like flint and steel, she knew it took great skill to create a fire that way. When she returned with her second load of branches, he was still missing. She was getting worried now. Gritting her teeth, she went to cut some of the tall grass by the river. The light was failing rapidly. "No way I'm going rambling around in the dark, looking for a nut job I hardly know," she growled to herself. Karen knew she was lying to herself, though. She had grown used to the stranger's presence, and being alone in the mountains without resources had begun to erode her natural confidence. She didn't relish sleeping alone through the cold night with nothing but grass for a blanket. Walking back with her arms full of fragrant, fresh-cut grass, she noticed the smoke immediately. "What the hell?" Quickening her steps, Karen reached the campsite in record time. Matthew was sitting in the middle of it, a small fire burning in front of him.
"How did you make a fire?" she asked,
but his reply was more gibberish. He held up something dark and furry.
"Food."
It was a dead marmot. Karen had never eaten wild game, and the thought of eating one of the cute animals would ordinarily have turned her stomach. Now, though, hunger and the prospect of starvation caused her to feel a surge of hope at the sight of the creature.
How did he catch that?
Matthew pointed upward, toward the limbs of a nearby tree. It took her almost a minute to spot what he was indicating, a brace of rabbits hanging from a tall branch some 50 feet off the ground.
Why did you put them up there? How did you put them up there?
She asked incredulously. He answered with a long series of words, none of which made any sense to her. Finally, he paused and, seeing her confusion, said simply, "Bear." He lifted his arms and growled, miming the grizzly they had met that morning. Karen sighed. She knew very well the dangers of keeping food in a campsite.
"Yes, yes, I understand. You don't want to attract bears, but how in the hell did you get them up there?"
He had no rope, and the rabbits had been spitted on what appeared to be a sharpened branch.
"Did you climb up there?"
The limbs were too small to support a man's weight at that point. Matthew grinned and pointed at himself.
"Nut job."
She laughed.
"At least you're honest."
They laughed together for several moments, though she doubted her companion understood what she found funny. It felt good to release the tension at last, but when the humour died away, she had to fight back tears. The past 2 days had been a serious shock, and now her emotions were working their way to the surface. He noticed the change in her and moved closer, patting her shoulder. When he lifted his hand and began to stroke her hair, she felt a shiver pass through her. There was something electric about his touch, as though his body emanated a peculiar heat that set fire to her nerves. For a second, she wanted to hold him.
"No, not him. Anyone. You're scared, Karen. A normal reaction for anyone in desperate circumstances."
She stepped away, cutting the moment short. The last thing she needed was to show vulnerability to this strange man. He seemed nice enough, but she was all too aware of the dangers men could pose, especially when there were no eyes watching to keep them honest. Even if he wasn't that sort, she had no desire to mislead a madman in the forest into thinking she had some sort of romantic interest in him. Looking over to see if she had offended him, she was surprised to discover that he had already moved back to the fire, seemingly oblivious to her awkwardness. It was abundantly clear that he had no interest in her. Placing more wood on the fire, he began to use his small knife to skin the marmot. Then she noticed her forearms. The hard work of cutting willow branches and dragging them back had made her sweat profusely. That, combined with the abrasion of leaves and limbs, had rubbed away the sunscreen from large areas of her skin. Her unnatural skin tone was showing through.
"What about my face?"
she thought, with a sense of panic. The light was dim, so it was possible he hadn't noticed. Moving calmly, she took her sunscreen out of her bag and walked toward the river. Once there, she applied it to her arms, neck, and face. Without a mirror, she couldn't be sure how good her efforts were.
"He probably saw my colouring earlier. I haven't thought about it all day."
It shouldn't matter. He was a complete stranger. Why would he care if she was an inbred freak? Chapter 6 Matthew built the fire carefully until it became a cheerful blaze. Then he let it die down, exposing a nice bed of hot coals. Fire had been a daily part of his existence growing up, though his family didn't use it nearly as much as the people in Castle Cameron did. One of the advantages of living in a house full of wizards was that there were always easier, less smoky ways to heat water or cook food, and heating their home hadn't been an issue at all. Here he needed to conserve his aether, so having a good fire was almost a necessity, rather than waste his resources keeping them warm in a more direct fashion. He had only used his magic to produce the initial flame. Karen seemed amazed when she saw his catch, but that didn't surprise him. Given the non-existent level of aether in her world, she had probably never met a wizard before. "Correction," he told himself. "She probably hasn't ever met a nut job before." He was picking up the basics of her vocabulary quickly, and he was confident that within a few days they would be able to communicate much more easily. After a short conversation, if it could be called that, Karen began to laugh, so he laughed along with her. When her laughter turned to tears, he felt vaguely uncomfortable, but he did his best to comfort her. Her dark mood seemed to pass quickly, so he returned to the task of dealing with the marmot he had chosen for their meal. Unfortunately, he wasn't particularly skilled at cooking. Most of his meals came out of a kitchen, and a lot of what he did know about preparing food didn't apply well when it came to camping and using an open fire. It also didn't help that they had virtually no ingredients to use for seasoning. Chad Grayson would have been particularly handy just then, and he wished he had spent more time learning from the man. Graham would probably be better suited to the task as well, since he had spent so much time learning woodcraft. Matthew knew the basics, though. He was confident he could keep them from starving. It was the flavour that worried him. A few vegetables would have been a big help, or even better, some salt. There was no use crying over the lack, however. He'd just make do with what they had. Some of the plants nearby might be edible, but he had no knowledge of which ones, and no desire to experiment. Using a few of the willow branches Karen had brought back, he saved some of the sweetmeats from the marmot, the liver, heart, and kidneys. After gutting the animal, he discarded the skin and sliced away the better cuts of meat. It had been a big one, and the meat reflected that, containing a significant amount of fat. His butchery wasn't the best, and he was glad his mother wasn't present to see his results. It hardly mattered, though, since it would all go in the pot together. They didn't have a pot, of course, but he had an idea to remedy that problem. It would cost him a little more of his aethar, but he thought the cost would be worth it. Standing up, he motioned toward Karen. "Let me borrow your hat." When that didn't work, he pointed at it, and tried the word he thought she had used for it previously. She took a step back, and after several confusing minutes, she eventually figured out what he was asking for. After removing it, she pointed at it and intoned her word for hat. Then she pointed at her head and used a different word. "Oh," he smirked, "I was asking her to give me her head." He turned the item over in his hands. It was made of some strange cloth, and it had a section close to the brim that was nothing but mesh. It had been sewn together with stitching that seemed impossibly perfect and even. The hatter that had made it must have been skilled beyond belief. "With stitching that fine, he should have been a tailor instead," Matthew observed. Karen asked him a question, pointing at the hat. "I'm going to cook our food in it," he replied, guessing at her question. When that failed to work, he turned it over and pointed to the bowl and used the word he was certain meant water. She frowned, and then pointed at the mesh band. "Well, obviously it won't hold water as it is," he replied. "Don't worry, though. I'm a nut job." Karen must have understood some of that, for she closed her eyes and covered her face with one hand. Apparently, she didn't believe he could make it work. "That's all right. I don't need you to believe me for it to work." Chanting a short phrase in Lycian, he focused his will. It was a spell he used frequently in his workshop, one that would make the hat impervious to flames. He modified it slightly to also make the fabric and mesh impermeable, so that the hat would hold water. Leaving the campfire, he walked down to the edge of the stream and dipped the hat into the flowing water, filling it halfway up. Then he returned and placed it carefully on the ground. He hadn't considered how he would keep it in place over the fire. Karen stared at it, clearly wondering why the water wasn't draining out of it. In his own world, he would have just used magic. In fact, he could have dispensed with the hat altogether and just kept the water in a temporary container of spell-wrought aethar. Even the fire would have been unnecessary. But here, he needed to conserve his aethar. Carefully, he fashioned a stand using willow branches. He wasted a bit more of his precious aethar binding the framework together and making it resistant to flame, and then he was ready. Karen yelled when he put the hat in the small rectangle that would hold it without letting it fall through into the fire. "Hey!" she cried, pointing at her hat, and following the exclamation with an impassioned speech in her native tongue. Matthew was forced to grab her when she moved to snatch her hat away from the fire. "Just watch," he told her. When that failed to dissuade her, he sent a thought directly into her mind, an easy task while they were touching, even though she wasn't a mage. "Your hat will be fine," he told her. "Trust me." She froze as his mind touched hers. Eyes wide, she stared at him, her mouth forming a small O of surprise. He heard her thoughts clearly, and though the words were strange, the meaning was clear. "What are you doing to me?" "This is just a different way to communicate. Be still a moment." Slowly, he lifted one hand, placing it against her cheek.
Sharing thoughts was easier the more direct the contact. The easiest solution would have been to put their heads together, but he didn't think she would react well if he tried that. "We can hear each other's thoughts now," he told her. Such close contact also had the effect of transmitting emotions more readily than even thoughts. As she stared at him, he felt a sudden warmth.
"Beautiful," came her thought.
Not wanting to embarrass her, he kept his own mind tightly contained. He started to explain his stewpot hat idea, but then his eyes fell on her left ear, which was now peeking through her curly hair. It tapered to a gentle point. He had seen ears like that before. Matthew's curiosity was immediate.
"Your ear?"
Karen's panic made her flinch, and she tried to pull away. Matthew tightened his grip on her wrist reflectively, and then her instincts kicked in. Turning her forearm, she twisted free of his hold and stepped forward slightly. Matthew tried to take a step back as her other arm snaked up and behind his head, grabbing his hair. His heel caught on her foot as she jerked downward on the back of his head, and then he was falling. He landed hard, the stony ground sending sharp reports of pain up through his spine as his butt struck the earth. Without thinking, he raised a shield to protect himself in case more attacks were forthcoming. She stood over him, her face flushing with embarrassment. Blurting out something that sounded like an apology, she turned and walked away, toward the river. Standing back up, Matthew released the shield. He already regretted wasting the aether. It had left him feeling light-headed. After she had left, he turned his attention back to the makeshift stewpot and began dropping pieces of marmot into it. Having grown up with a sister, he was well acquainted with sudden changes in mood. He didn't really understand it, but he had learned not to think too deeply on such things. People were either rational or they weren't, and if it was the latter, he didn't believe in rewarding them with extra attention. It wasn't worth his time and effort. "I'll just avoid the topic of her ears from now on," he thought, filing the information away. Instead, he considered the marmot stew. He would have added the bones as well. You couldn't eat them, but they might have given it a better flavor. The problem was that the hat wasn't nearly large enough to accommodate them along with everything else. Karen watched the moonlight reflecting from the ripples in the stream. Ordinarily, she considered herself an extremely level-headed person, not given to excesses of emotion. But the last few days had left her in a mess. She was tired, sore, hungry, and suffering from 2 days of accumulated stress. Somehow, she thought the situation would have been both more frightening and less stressful if she had been alone through it all. Alone, there was nothing to cry over. Alone, there was no one to judge you for your appearance. You just got up off your ass and did the best you could. Alone, failure would simply have meant freezing or starving, possibly to death. That seemed infinitely preferable to having someone staring at her birth defects. "It's not as though I chose to be born of inbred parents, or to have this weird skin," she told herself. "It wasn't my choice to be unable to tolerate an interface. I never wanted to be a freak." But she was. It set her apart, like a living relic from the past. She was forced to use antiquated technology that made her forever inferior to her counterparts, whether it was gaming or working, or just trying to summon her damned pert to get her out of the goddamned mountains. It should have come as no surprise that her mother wanted little to do with her. Who would want to admit to having been parent to someone as defective as she was? That was why she had come hiking alone. That was why she had so few friends. Alone was always better. Online, her physical appearance mattered little, but even there she was treated with contempt, or perhaps pity.
"Poor Karen, always forced to use archaic interfaces. She won't be fast enough to keep up with us."
That's what she imagined, they said, when she wasn't present.
"You're being too hard on yourself, Karen, and making assumptions that probably aren't true," she said aloud.
That's what her father would have said. But it was hard to really believe it. She wrenched her thoughts away from the old ruts and turned them back to what had just happened. Beyond her embarrassment, there were things happening that made no sense whatsoever. How had he done what he did with her hat? Most of the water should have drained out of it. The fire should have burned it.
and what the hell was that light that sprang up around him when I knocked him on his arse? Had that really been his voice in her head?
I may have to rethink this wizard thing, she said wryly. Or my own sanity. That could be where the problem lies.
Chapter 7 Senior Defense Coordinator Donald Aisman was watching the sunset over the sea when the alert came in. It was in the middle of his rest period, which was unusual in itself. Ordinarily, any urgent issues would go to the first Deputy Defense Coordinator, John Wang, during Donald's off-time. For it to be sent up the chain during his rec time meant it had to be particularly important. A quick mental command opened the channel, and Donald watched as a large three-dimensional display opened on the sand in front of him. Beside it was a two-dimensional flat display, showing John Wang's concerned features.
"Evening, John," he said, greeting his deputy informally. "What's going on?"
"We have a possible Class 6 alert," replied John, his normally impassive features revealing signs of well-controlled anxiety. Donald sat up.
"What nature?"
"The ANSYS interferometer network has detected a gravitational ripple. Neutrino detectors around the world are also registering an uptick in detection events."
Donald frowned.
"Another incursion?
It meets all the criteria. It's either that or a micro black hole just hit the Rockies, but that wouldn't agree with the neutrino data, and we'd have other markers," said John, his voice flat and unemotional.
The SDC stood and, with a quick command, changed his status from off-duty to active. The beach dissolved around him, to be replaced by the sterile aesthetics of the UN Defense Command Center. His attire simultaneously shifted as well, becoming a smart military uniform with clean lines and few decorations other than his insignia of rank. The FDDC, John, stood in front of him. Donald spoke to the air.
"Give me a satellite visual of the area in question."
The furniture around them faded into insubstantiality, and the floor became a top-down view of the Rocky Mountains, centered over what had once been known as Colorado. An oval region, roughly 100 miles in diameter, was highlighted with a red glow.
"This is our best estimate of where the epicenter of the event may be," noted the FDDC. "As you can see, it appears to be somewhere in the mountains west of Boulder."
"There are still organics living there," observed the SDC.
John nodded.
"Yes, it's one of the few cities in the region that still retains a significant population. Almost everything else in the region has undergone reclamation. It's possible that it's their target."
Donald's brows furrowed.
"You're assuming it's the Shiha?"
His deputy shrugged.
"It's the best arrivable conclusion we can make from the data we have at this point."
"There are other possibilities," said the SDC. "We can't rule them out yet."
John shook his head negatively.
"There's never been a confirmation of any extraterrestrial intelligence, nor do we have any evidence that FTL travel is possible. Our best assumption would be that this is another demon event."
"Even if it is demons, we don't know that it is the Shiha," countered Donald.
"Either way, we have to work on the assumption that this is a hostile incursion," said John.
The SDC nodded.
"This is uncomfortably close to the primary CC in Kansas City.
Untold billions live there, hosted on the largest server network on the planet." Donald took a moment to mentally toggle through the most recent image analysis of the highlighted region. Nothing stood out. Whatever had come through there hadn't made a big enough splash to show up on satellite. Donald made a quick decision.
"Call up the UN cybernetic reserves from the Gulf Coast. I want every unit activated and sent in. We need boots on the ground."
"Cybernetics, sir?" responded his deputy. "Are you sure we shouldn't respond with an alpha strike?"
"That's a knee-jerk reaction, John. We need more information first. It's a big universe. Even if it is a demon event, we don't know that it is the Shiha again," replied Donald.
"We don't want a repeat of Australia, sir."
Donald fought to suppress a growl. It always came back to Australia. He had known his second would bring it up eventually. 50 years before, humanity had nearly lost to the Shiha. The war had only been brought to a successful conclusion by sacrificing the entirety of the southern continent.
That is precisely why I'd prefer not to respond to our first warning in decades with a nuclear strike, said the SDC. He glanced at the map again. A yellow number hovered over the city of Boulder. There are still 16,000 organics living in close proximity to the detection region. His deputy wasn't ready to back down yet, though. Over 20 million were lost in Australia, but if we hadn't had the balls to do it then, there wouldn't be a human race any more. There are over 10 billion people counting on us to make the right decision here. And 16,000 organics don't matter enough to have any weight in that decision. They're people too, John. Sometimes I wonder if you lost your soul when you transitioned. We aren't machines. The FDDC smirked.
Technically we are machines, Donald, but that isn't the point. We can't let our hearts overrule reasoned judgment.
Donald shook his head.
I hope you don't talk to your wife like that. I don't think remarks like that would go over well at home.
I keep my professional life entirely separate from my personal life. Maxine understands that, replied John. The director closed his eyes.
I've made my decision. We send in the cybernetics. This is what they were created for. The Shi'ar had years in Australia before we were forced to that terrible moment. If we discover an infection taking hold in the mountains, we can reevaluate the situation at that point.
What about drone troops?
I don't trust telepresence for this. We need men on the ground. Limit telepresence to aerial drone support and reconnaissance.
There's an organic guard division still active in Kansas. Should we bring them in as well?
They're closer, suggested his deputy.
Organics are too vulnerable to the special abilities that the Shi'ar employ. Alert them, but tell them to remain on standby.
Deputy Wang arched one brow.
So you do think it's the Shi'ar?
I only posited that it could be something new. I'd be a fool to proceed without proper precautions. Let's get started.
Already relaying the command sequences, sir, said the FDDC. If we're done, I'll take my leave. They need my presence on site.
Very good, replied the SDC.
John Wang vanished, and for a moment he was alone in the command center.
I'd better let Regina know why I left so suddenly.
She wouldn't be happy when he told her he would likely be missing dinner, but he knew she would understand. His wife was a practical woman, after all. Cold air was blowing down the nape of Matthew's neck. The morning dew made his clothing damp, which exacerbated the problem. On top of that, he ached all over, and he could feel knots in his muscles every time he tried to shift his position, which wasn't easy with Karen next to him. Next probably wasn't the right word. Entangled might be better for his current circumstances. She had returned to camp after the stew finished cooking, without uttering a word. She hadn't seemed angry, and he hadn't really cared, so he had simply given her the hat with her portion. He had already eaten his. Without utensils, she had been forced to pick the meat out with her fingers, and then drink the greasy broth that remained once that was done. He had taken the hat to the river to rinse and refill it, boiling another portion of water so she could fill her water bottle. After that, he had collapsed onto the willow and grass bed she had put together, covering himself with as much grass as he could manage. He wanted to avoid using another warming spell. His aether had almost reached its limit. Karen had crawled in shortly after, and they had started out with a perfectly respectable space between them, but the night had been cold, and sleeping people prized warmth above all else. He hadn't protested when she began to encroach on his territory. He had been cold, too, after all. But once she had gotten fully to sleep, he had begun to feel smothered. His dreams, when he had managed to drift off, were dominated by nightmares in which he was slowly being strangled by some tentacled sea monster. Matthew contemplated his current situation with aplomb and a small amount of well-controlled disgust. Somehow her hair kept finding its way into his mouth and nose, despite the fact that he had turned his head to face completely away from her. She also smelled. For that matter, so did he, but he could resign himself to his own stink. Both of them radiated an aura of sweat, dirt, and body odor, all overlaid by the light addition of smoke and greasy marmot. To be honest, Karen's hair was the best part of the whole unpleasant mess, for it had an additional floral scent that helped to filter out some of the other smells.
I want a bath,
he thought silently. But the idea of submerging himself into the frigid waters of the nearby stream sent another shiver down his spine. His aether had recovered somewhat during the night, but not to the degree it should have. Not enough that he wanted to waste it heating water or drying himself. He had decided he would do his best to avoid using his magic for anything that day, to see how long it would take for his aether to fully restore itself. Karen groaned, shifting her weight and tightening her grip on his waist. "I'd never hear the end of it if Moira could see me like this," he thought idly. Turning his head slightly to look at the woman next to him, he got another face full of hair. Her head was on his shoulder, and she was breathing into his neck, something that might have been erotic if her breath hadn't been so foul. He exhaled again, and he felt the hair on the back of his neck stand up. He was forced to remind himself again how disgusted he was. She had one arm around his waist, and her left leg was draped across his thighs, entirely too close to something he didn't want to think about. To distract himself, he examined her ears with his mage sight. Her curly hair was effective at keeping them hidden most of the time, even without her hat, but that meant nothing to mage sight. This close, it was easy to discern their shape, especially since she had definitely begun to radiate a small amount of aether on her own. It was still dim, but he could tell it was brighter than the day before. She had none when I first met her, but now she's begun to produce it on her own, just like any normal person back home. Had he done that? Perhaps aether was something like a fire. Once started, it could spread and grow. Would other people begin to produce aether if he spent time near them? Without thinking about it, he let his attention drift, following the lines of her body beneath the oddly colored clothing she wore. Soft curves and smooth skin covered a form supported by strong muscles. Karen was a tall woman who practically radiated good health. Her long legs tapered gently and... Matthew caught himself then. "I need to pee." Gently lifting her arm, he moved it to her side, but as soon as he released it, she shifted and moved it back part way. "Not there." If he rolled away quickly and stood up, perhaps he could get away before she woke enough to realize how embarrassing their situation had become, particularly for him. Then again, she might wake instantly and decide I somehow finagled her into this position. She awoke as soon as he started moving, her eyes popping open to fix on him as he slid from beneath her leg and arm. If she noticed anything regarding his condition, or was embarrassed herself, she gave no sign of it. Karen yawned and sat up to stare bleary-eyed at the now defunct campfire. That suited Matthew fine, and he walked away to relieve himself. When he returned, he found her looking up at the rabbits still hanging in the tree above. Nodding, he looked up and uttered a short phrase, snapping his fingers at the same time. The small branch the animals were spitted on broke cleanly off, and the carcasses fell into his waiting hands. "So much for not using my magic today," he thought. "But that was just a tiny bit. Hopefully, I won't need to do anything else." The rabbits were missing their heads and innards. He had dressed them the day before, but left the skins on to keep the meat clean until they were ready to cook them. It had been another cold night, and while it might get quite warm toward the middle of the day, he was confident they would last until that evening. Digging around in the remains of the fire, he removed the still-burning coals and placed them on a heap of moderately dry grass before wrapping the entire collection up in a large piece of the marmot's now semi-dry hide. It was a messy piece of work, but with some luck they would have a fire that evening without requiring him to use more magic. He tied the bag up with a thin strip of willow bark and then suspended it on the branch holding the two rabbits. Karen had been watching him with some interest and commented several times, but he hadn't understood anything she had said. Eventually she had walked down to the stream to wash her face and hands while he finished his preparations. When she returned, he saw that she had reapplied the strange cream she carried, using it on her face and neck. He also noted that she had missed a spot, and that the skin there seemed strangely discolored. A bruise? After all that they had been through, that seemed the most likely explanation. He decided not to comment on it. She looked at her hat with some distaste. He had cleaned it in the river the night before, but it still retained a smell of smoke and grease. With a shrug, she put it on her head anyway.
They were in no position to be picky. They set off and made better time that day, being both better rested and somewhat fed from the marmot the night before. After several hours, Matthew broached the topic that had begun to worry him. "How long until we reach your home?" he asked. Karen stopped, and after a short, frustrating bit of back and forth, it became apparent he was getting nowhere. Matthew held up one hand and mimed putting it on her forehead without approaching her. He didn't want a repeat of the previous night's embarrassment. She looked worried, but nodded after a second. So he stepped forward and placed his palm on her temple, making sure to avoid getting his fingers close to her ear. "How long before we reach your village?" The words were strange, but their meaning was clear to her, so she answered in the same fashion. "I don't have a village. We need to reach the nearest ranger station so I can call for help." He nodded. "How far away is it? Are we close?" "We aren't on the trail anymore, so I'm not sure where we are," she confided. "My best guess is another 3 days if we keep heading east. Even if we miss the station, we will eventually find a road at the edge of the national park." As she communicated mentally, his mind catalogued the words she used along with their meaning. She asked another question before he could respond. "Who are you? Where are you from?" Matthew doubted she would understand the answer if he tried to give her the truth, so he kept it simple. "Somewhere far away, a place called Lothian. I am here to learn about your people." Karen frowned. His answer sounded like something from a science fiction film. Her hand reached for her pocket reflexively to retrieve her PM so she could do a search on Lothian. The name sounded vaguely European to her, but beyond that she had no idea where the place was. With a sigh, she gave up on the idea as she remembered the loss of her device. "Is that somewhere in Eastern Europe?" she asked. That would explain his strange language. Matthew stifled a laugh. "A little farther than that." Pulling away, he held up a hand to let her know to wait as he found a place to sit. He needed to think. 3 days was a long time, and without access to his normal resources it would be a miserable trip. He didn't fancy the idea of living on nothing but wild game for so long. He was also sick of being dirty. In his own world, it was common for people to go weeks at a time without bathing, but that wasn't the case in his family. Personal hygiene was particularly easy for wizards, cold water was never a barrier, and there was rarely the problem of transporting water. He needed to be able to use his powers freely. He needed access to the tools and supplies he kept in his interdimensional pouch. Either would significantly improve their situation, and both would make traveling a breeze. Reaching out, he raised his hand and Karen stepped forward, indicating he could place it on her head once more. "I need to go home for a short time," he told her. "Can you wait here for me?" Her response was a pure sense of inquiry, a summation of every question in one, a pure question mark. After a moment, she managed to rephrase it. "How will you leave?" "It's difficult to explain. You'll understand when you see it. Wait here and I should return within a day. I can make our journey much easier when I get back." She didn't like the idea of being left alone, or wasting an entire day. The situation was dire enough as it was. "I'll leave the rabbits for you. Rebuild the fire and it won't be so bad," he suggested. "I still don't understand," she replied. Stepping away from her, he placed the branch holding the rabbits on the ground. "Watch," he said aloud. Closing his eyes, he let his perception widen, slipping sideways into the space between. It was more than a purely mental exercise, though, and he began to strain to find enough aether to breach the invisible barrier that separated the plane of existence he was currently on from the infinity that lay between. Sweat stood out on his brow, and his hands began to shake from the effort. If he failed, the consequences might be dire, for he was putting everything he had left into the attempt. Matthew's heart began to pound in his chest, as though straining to escape, and then he broke through. Karen watched with some skepticism at what appeared to be a theatrical performance, until she saw the edges of his figure begin to blur. In the space of a few seconds, he faded away, like a dream upon waking. The place he had been was empty. She was struck with an instantaneous sense of loneliness, made worse by a feeling of madness. Had she imagined it all? There was no trace of him left, no evidence he had ever existed. Thinking back over the past 2 days, she could think of nothing that might not have been a product of a vivid hallucination. Perhaps she was insane. Then her eyes fell on the branch, still holding the 2 rabbits and a pouch of uncured marmot hide. "I'm not crazy," she told herself. "He was real." She sat down suddenly and hugged her knees, fighting a strange urge to cry. Taking a deep breath, she steadied herself. "I'm stronger than that," she thought. Getting up again, she retrieved the pouch containing the still-burning coals and set about making a new camp. Chapter 8 Matthew found himself in darkness once more, but it was a comforting darkness. His mage sight once again showed him the terrain for a great distance in every direction, and he felt the warm presence of Aethar everywhere. It was something he had never noticed before, until he had experienced its absence. It was like standing in the sunshine after emerging from a cold shadow. Even so, he found himself falling. He had pushed too far, and now his legs had betrayed him. Crumpling to the ground, he maintained only enough presence of mind to manage his fall and avoid striking his head when he reached the hard stone floor. With a sigh of relief, he drew a deep breath, and then he lost consciousness. When he awoke, it was some time later, though how much later he had no way of knowing. His cheek lay against the cold ground, and his body felt half frozen as he sat up, and his nerves began to come back to life. With a thought and a word, he heated the air around him, creating a warm envelope to insulate himself. "Ah," he sighed internally. He was definitely home. Well, not home exactly, but close enough. Winding his way through the cave, he walked out into the night, greeted by a sky full of familiar stars. His hand found his pouch and he opened it, reaching in to discover it once again connected to the pocket dimension that held his tools. Matthew smiled. His strength was largely back. He had probably slept for quite a few hours. Mentally, he reviewed what he needed to do before returning. Checking in with his mother and explaining the situation should probably be first on the list, but that option held no appeal. He discarded the idea quickly. Given the complete absence of Aethar in the other world, he should probably take something that held a significant store of Aethar for use if he exhausted himself again. "Like a dragon," he thought ruefully. Leaving Desiccus behind was a stupid thing to do. He would have to make finding Desiccus a priority when he returned. In the meantime, he had something in his pouch that should serve the same purpose. Exploring the interior of the pouch, he pulled out another bag. This one was a bit larger than the size of a fist, and it held a collection of some 20-odd iron spheres. Each was charged with as much Aethar as it could hold, and the enchantment on them was designed to release that power instantly when the user supplied the proper command word with the correct intention. They were a copy of his father's iron bonds, and one of the first enchantments he had ever done on his own in his early teens. It had been a project he worked on in secret at the time. No parent wanted to discover their child was making explosives. Since then, he had grown capable of much greater enchantments with far more subtlety and usefulness. But these still held a special place in his heart. He had only ever used a few of them, primarily to test them out. The rest he had stored and never felt a need to use. They would be perfect for what he needed now. Next, he removed a large woolen blanket and then opened it on the ground. He placed the bag of iron spheres in the middle and then began removing other things from the pocket dimension. Slowly, a pile of useful things built up. His silver stylus, used for crafting delicate enchantments, a small wooden box containing his shield stones, a rope, a heavy-duty padded bedroll, an enchanted male hauberk and leggings, an empty waterskin, a large iron pot with a variety of utensils. They were all added to the collection on the blanket. He also added a leather case containing a set of needles, thread, and scissors. A long strip of white cloth was laid next to it. He would need that to create a new storage pouch when he went back. Last but not least, he took out his enchanted staff and lay it across the top of the now large pile. He felt a sense of pride looking at it. The smooth ash wood was chased with silver runes from tip to crown.
He had felt woefully unprepared in the other world when he had discovered he no longer had access to it. Studying his pile, Matthew regretted that he only had one bedroll. That might give Karen the